Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
It's the third time for Wicomico County Executive Rick Pollitt as voters prepare to cast their ballots in this November's election. And challenging Pollitt is Wicomico County Council Member Bob Culver. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. No matter which man is elected, he will face still an uncertain economic future as the nation struggles to recover from the Great Recession. And in its wake, the region has seen cutbacks in state funding as the state in Annapolis tries to deal with its own financial woes. First of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Don. Thanks for having us.
Appreciate you.
Rick, well, I'm going to start with you with that nice generalized question is why anybody should vote for you again, right? What's your argument that you should have yet another term?
Well, Don, I think now is the time we really make our mark to show where the benefit of having a county executive can come to play. The first term was mostly about transition, about getting people used to the fact that it was a different way of government. And then the recession hit us, and the balance of the first term was pretty much making all of those tough choices to slash back to bare bones government so that we try to keep some level of quality with our services with the resources that we had. But in the meantime, we didn't just sit around wringing our hands talking about how bad things were. We've put together a number of community teams of decision makers from across the board in Wicomico County to start mapping out a plan of how we're going to define ourselves under what I call the new normal and how we're going to regain our stature as the hub of Delmarva. Focusing on economic development, focusing on showing why we're a good opportunity for people still to come raise a family, have their businesses, that sort of thing. And so we've got all of that structure in place now, and it's already paying dividends. So I would like to have one more term to actually see this come to be, and so that we can see Wicomico County not only in recovery, but moving ahead stronger than we had any time before.
By the way, one question about that. Do you see this? Do you expect that you might see another term after this, or do you think this will be your final term?
I don't speculate on that. I would think this will probably do it, but you know, it depends on what you're doing at the time.
Bob, usually these elections, particularly when you have an incumbent, is a referendum on the incumbent in much of it. Why is it that somebody should say replace Rick and say bring in you?
Well, I feel like now's the time for a change. There's been 7 years of Rick's administration, and although I don't blame him for the recession, I would like to, but I can't blame him for the recession in that part, but I just feel like we have to take this from a business approach. I'm a businessman, Rick's a bureaucrat, in the sense that I've always been in my life been in business, having to make money, make decisions, tough decisions, and go on. They're not all easy. Rick has had some tough times to go with, I'll grant him that, but the point is I feel like we need to change now and look at this as a business. Wicomico County is a $129 billion business, and now is the time to have a businessman in.
Let me ask you this. Where do you think he's gone wrong? I mean, obviously he's had to face the tough economic times, but where do you think he went wrong?
I feel like some of the spending, I don't agree with some. I'll give you a quick example here.
Yeah.
You've got to cut every dollar, and especially in this climate, every dollar has got to be watched. We, on the county council, approved a motion last year to buy our own tar and chip equipment in the roads division. $200,000, $300,000. I checked this year to find out how that's going, how are we making out doing that. It seems that we have nobody that knows how to do the tar and chip. So we now have had to sub that out to another company. We should have never bought the equipment till we knew that our men were prepared to be able to do that. So that alone is just about a cent tax on your raise to fund that equipment.
Rick, what about that?
Well, it's not the whole story. Our roads department took the biggest cut during the recession. It used to be before the recession that it was traditional across the state for municipal and county highway departments to fund all of their operations through the state highway user revenues. The state cut that as they dealt with their budget crisis. Wicomico County went from an annual total of about $7 million down to $200,000. Now, our general budget wasn't equipped to make up that kind of cut. So when we laid off employees, the biggest number of employees came out of our roads department. We had to take money out of the general fund, money that would normally have been spent in the other county services, in order to have a bare bones roads program just to keep the roads safe. And so it's not a matter of the guys not knowing how to do it. It's right now we don't have the full complement of people working for roads. Now we're building that back. The idea is that this was an opportunity for an investment that will allow us to do more of our own roads maintenance going forward with less people and at less cost. And so we see this as an investment that will pay dividends over the years. And this summer, we've actually got a pretty aggressive roads maintenance program underway. We've had two or three separate projects under, or groups of projects underway. And while our staffing is still diminished in roads, we've got the equipment now, and as things start to turn around, we'll be able to make use of this investment that we've put into equipment so that we can save money down the road. It's an investment.
I mean, one of the questions I guess Bob would ask would be, did we just buy it too soon?
No, not at all. The deal was there. We were able to bring it in, and we are going to be using it.
Bob, just real quick.
We did buy it too soon. The concept of us being able to do our own work would be great, but again, that was $300,000 that we spent that we can't use right now. We also purchased about $700,000 worth of mower equipment. Now, with that mower equipment, we have another problem. We can't cut all the roads. You take out by the airport where we have curb and guttering, our mowers will not cut that. Somebody just didn't understand what happened. It's a different type of mower rather than what we call a bush hog. It was a flail top mower, and it has to be down all the way in order to cut. So there are some problems, and those are things that are going to be able to be worked out. I realize that, but we've made a large investment in our roads. I think we've got a great roads department. I can't see where they've done wrong. I actually rode with them during this snow season, and they are all very conscientious. They're very good workers, and they had the county in mind when they do it. But that purchase, personally, in my opinion, was made too early.
Let me turn to taxes. We've had a series of taxes, I think, over the last 5 years, tax increases. Are those justified?
Sure. And I think the thing we need to be careful about, because this is so tempting, especially in a political year, there's two separate conversations. If you're talking about raising taxes to raise more money and do more spending, that's one conversation. And maybe there is a time for that. Maybe the community feels there is a need for increased investment in a particular service of some kind. But that's not what we've been doing. That's not been the conversation we've been able to have during the recession. The other conversation is when you need to adjust the tax rate to compensate for a diminished value of your tax base so that you can at least keep a consistent and reliable flow of revenues coming in from one year to the next just to fund your core services. And so as the housing market in the economy crashed and the property values diminished, the tax rate under the provisions of our revenue cap was increased just to keep funding basically to break even level. Now, this year, the county council, by a vote of 5 out of the 7 members, voted to increase the rate by about a nickel. Now, 4 cents of that 5 was just to break even, what they call the constant yield. The other penny brings in about $700,000. And again, that's to try to keep some consistent level of service for the people that demand and expect services from us. And that was that's the conversation we've been having, which is totally different from raising taxes to do more spending. We don't do that.
Bob, I believe you voted against it.
I did vote against it. And you can say what you want to as far as constant yield. I realize that. But here on the Eastern Shore, we have an old adage, if it walks like a duck, sounds like a duck, it's a duck. We raise taxes. I understand the constant yield. That's fine. But the point is we hit people when they are at their lowest by having to raise taxes, either for a constant yield. What should have been done was to go back to the original budget, start every budget back at zero base, and we'll start over again and see just what we can cut, what we can take out of that. I'm not saying cut personnel. I'm saying, but there are some things that we could probably cut out of that, and maybe we would not have had to go a tax increase. Now Rick's great on telling me that I did not vote for his budget, and I didn't. My first point, though, was to send it back to the executive's office and ask for him to rework it so that we did not have a tax increase. I did not want to see a tax increase when people were facing the economic times that we are now facing.
Go ahead.
I want to be sure that everybody understands the nuances here. You're talking about a tax increase. When the tax rate increases based on the value of the property, the actual impact to most taxpayers is not going to be seen because you're paying the same amount of money because your property value is lower. So the rate goes up, but you're not increasing your tax payments. Now, as far as the budget goes, part of the conversation when the county council voted to adopt my budget was that even to make a penny cut of some $700,000 or $800,000, the only place when most of your tax revenue goes into spent or public education or public safety, the only place in the budget to make that level of a cut would have been to lay off about 10 police or sheriff deputies. Even Gil Barkovich, who has never been a strong supporter of my budgets, said that the council went through the budget carefully looking for places to cut, and there really wasn't any. And I want to also make sure people understand this isn't a political issue. Four of the six Republicans on the county council voted for this budget with this tax rate increase. And they did that because they realized this was the only responsible thing to do if we're going to maintain solvency in our product and if the people are going to see the level of services. And apparently we're doing the right thing because the bond rating agencies on Wall Street, who know as much if not more about the state of the county's fiscal health than anyone, have upgraded our ratings just in the worst of the recession as a strong testimonial to how we're managing the public's dollars. And I think if anybody is looking for a shot of encouragement, the fact that people who know what they're talking about say that we're managing the public dollar correctly and efficiently is right there in front of them. And I'm perfectly happy to rely on that.
There's not a business or an operation in this county who has not, during this recession, gone back and started their budget over again to see where they could trim the fat. We have increased our budget. We're up to $129 million. We want $1.3 million more this year than we did last year. And I understand constant yield, but everybody has had to cut services. Everybody's had to cut their own household expenses. You know, whether we turn electricity down a little bit, cut the air conditioner to 80 instead of 76 or something, we've all had to make cuts. We've had to make in the gas prices and that type of thing. So there's no reason that the government shouldn't have done the same thing. And, you know, I realize what Rick does give is got valid points, but at the same time, you're working with a county that has 98,000 people, average income is 35,000 per person. And that's hard on the average family. And I just don't think that the government should have done that to the citizens of Wicomico County.
What about this idea that if I'm a homeowner, I'm not going to see my payment go up. It's just simply going to stay flat. In other words, so that all you're doing is keeping taxes sort of basically the same. I mean, that's what Rick's argument is. Does that ameliorate it at all for you?
And that's true if you're on that third year. Every three years, your home gets reassessed. But if you happen to be 2 years away from that, you see a tax increase this year. And you may not see it next year. But it's because of your assessment based on your house. And while that's good if everything was reassessed every year, it's not reassessed every year. So it's every third year. So there are people that saw tax increases. There are people that maybe saw a tax decrease on their real property because their assessment went down.
Rick?
Yeah, and I just wanted to make this point very clear. We did cut back. We, during the worst of the recession, we slashed our budgets in every single department across the board. You may remember we got into some pretty serious hot water with the state when we cut our spending for education below maintenance of effort, and we had to apply for a waiver of the state required maintenance of effort standard of funding. We've cut every single department. When you lay off 40 some 50 employees and close down another 20 or 30 jobs beyond that, and you can't even give those employees 2 weeks notice because of technology and access to computers and all the risks involved. When you have someone come to work after providing years of service to the county and they're greeted with a cardboard box and a thank you and a pat on the back for your service, don't tell me we haven't cut. We went for 4 years with absolutely zero raises for county employees, 3 years of furloughs when we couldn't even pay the employees what we hired them for. So we did make, during the worst of the recession, we made the serious cuts and we slashed our budget down to the bone. It's only been as now we've bottomed out, and while we're not we're not in recovery, it seems clear that the worst is behind us, and now we're taking advantage of the savings that we've been able to build up to catch up with some one-time expenses. And our basic budgetary goal is to match recurring revenues to recurring expenses so that we're not just raising taxes for increased spending. We've done our due diligence in cutting the budget. And, you know, still, as the county executive, my job is to make sure the services are there that people expect. And that means having a strong education system, public safety, and trying to keep our infrastructure in place.
Bob?
Well, I guess I have to disagree to a certain extent on that, too. I mean, again, we've had to make some cuts, and there's no doubt about that. The county's had to take some cuts on that. But we're not continuing those cuts. And honestly, we are not out of the recession. you came to us 2 years ago and said things are looking good. Governor O'Malley had said, oh yeah, things are starting to improve and we're looking better. You know, this is what we're going to do. We've not seen that. We had to take, because we lost income from income taxes last year, we had to take $2 some million out of our roads division to balance the budget. And that in turn, I think we're living in a dream world if you want to think that we had to take that the recession is even behind us. You know, being in the business world, the recession is not behind us. We're still right in the middle of it. We're not done bleeding yet before we start to heal. Now, you can come back and say we didn't take it out of that because we no longer have a enterprise account, that we have a general fund. Well, we had that set inside there to do roads last year, but the story still remains that we took it out of that to balance the budget because of shortfall in income tax revenue.
Bob's corrected his own mistake. Because we were always able to fund our roads department through the money from the state, it was what we call an enterprise account where there was no real tax dollars, local tax dollars involved in roads. As it became clear that we were not going to recover the highway user revenues that the state took from us, then the sheer honesty in accounting and financial management showed that we needed to bring roads back into the general fund. Roads came into the general fund with a reserve fund available to them. Since we had not brought in the revenue from income tax that we had expected, that money then became a resource to go back to the service so that we could continue with, as I said before, some semblance of a roads program to keep the potholes filled and keep the roads safe. But that's exactly the way it was. And it was not a matter of having to spend money that wasn't appropriate for that use.
My understanding is that the state basically almost virtually wiped out what it was giving you.
About 97%.
Yeah, right. I'll turn to Bob because I want you to respond. So when you're faced with that kind of deficit, that is the money not coming from Annapolis, what do you think the county should be doing then?
Well, I do feel that strongly we should be throwing our objections to the state, and I think Rick has done that in the sense of he was on a committee this past year to try to reinstate our HUR money. And, you know, we've got delegates. We've got great delegates here. We need to convince them that somehow, no, they've got to convince the other delegates that the counties need that HUR money. It is our money. It's money that we paid at our tax, at our filling stations for tax for our roads, and we need to get that money back. I don't know if you challenge them legally or what you can do, but we need to challenge it. We can't just take whatever the state or the governor says we have to do and then go with it. We've got to challenge that because this, what happens in Anne Arundel County is not always good for Wicomico County, Montgomery County. They're all together different. We have so many things, but I believe we need to challenge that. But we do have an avenue that we could possibly go through and get a little bit through the gas. We're allowed to charge gas tax. If we knew that money was going to go to our roads, I believe people will do that. They'll help you fix our own roads. It's giving all of our money to the state and then them letting us tell us what they're going to do with it and tell us how to run it.
Let me ask you, do you think, Bob, do you think that the county, and counties in general, but this county, is too dependent upon state funding?
We're very dependent on state funding. We get a disparity grant of about $7 million. I think that's what it was last year. And even though it's gone up the last couple of years, it's like our welfare check. And I don't want to see us keep getting welfare checks. We need to stand on our own as much as we can. We need that money, that's true, but it's actually money that was our money, and we need to bring it back to our county. We've got some of the greatest agricultural production companies here in Wicomico County. I mean, you start off just with Purdue. Wicomico County is the number one state producer of agricultural products in the state of Maryland, and we need to be proud of that, so we need to go back to that. So we need to try to bring those programs back to us that we are putting towards paying forward at this point.
Rick, what are we too dependent upon the state?
Well,
I will tell you, by the way, that in the state of Maryland, as a local government, you're not alone. I saw the same thing in California. So, I mean, do you think we're too?
I don't think we're too dependent because, as you've seen, when that resource is challenged, then we are able to find ways to mitigate that to an extent. But when you look at all of the revenue that we receive from the state, whether it's Board of Education for our schools, whether it's Program Open Space that allows us to buy conservation easements over sensitive land to preserve for agriculture, whether it's for the police funding, we actually bring in more year to year in state funds than we have in our entire county budget. And so when the state takes something like highway user revenues, 97% away from us, that does provide, that does impact us terrifically. What I'd like to do, if I can take just a minute, is, you know, we've talked about just what I've said we're trying not to do in my office, and that's wring our hands about how bad things are. We know that we still got plenty of challenges, and I've said repeatedly, we're not out of recession. You know, the rest of the country, the indicators seem to be that most other places are moving forward. We're gradually inching ahead. I think, as I said, the worst is behind us, and I don't think you can challenge that too much. So what we want to do is, all right, how are we going to progress going forward? We're putting so much emphasis now on economic development. We're developing comprehensive plans of how we can better utilize our airport resource. How can we tie into all these exciting things going on in Wallops Island? What we can do to make our airport more of an economic engine? We're looking at the Port of Salisbury, talking about how we can deepen the riverbed so that we can bring in more transportation. We have Chesapeake Shipbuilder, the only tugboat building company on the East Coast. We, through my initiatives, did three major outreaches to business. One, we were able to get legislation through Annapolis to decouple the property tax from the personal property tax, so that for the last 2 years, our business community has paid far less in taxes than they would have been without our initiative. We also are phasing out our inventory tax. We're also making our manufacturer's tax exemption automatic. So we're creating a climate where business A knows that we're behind them and we want them to succeed, and we want to have an active partnership to build economic development in Wicomico County. And secondly, we can focus on the jobs that are going to come from that, and it's that increase in our job base and putting people back to work that's going to let us be more resilient and provide for ourselves to compensate for what we've lost from other areas.
Bob, what about those efforts? Are they enough? What do you assess them? I think, well, as a businessman,
I look at it, we've had 7-8 years of Rick's administration. I'm thinking it's too little, too late. We should have been on this in year 2006 and started with that then. I mean, it's great that Chesapeake Shipbuilding is here. Great company, they're doing wonderful works. Everybody's just amazed at what they build there. But I don't believe it's because of Rick's administration. It's been there. You know, we're helping it along as well as the council's helping along. We want to keep our rivers open because of the shipping that we need between Purdue, the oil companies. Cato brings a lot of oil in here. We need to keep our riverbed open. It's very important. River transportation is for Wicomico County. Being the second largest port in the state of Maryland, we need to capitalize on that. Now, we need to do a lot more. There's nothing wrong with a county making money in the sense of, I'm not so much in favor of enterprise accounts, I'll be honest with you, because those enterprise accounts are funded by the people of Wicomico County. So that if we make money in whether it be parks and recreation, landfill, that all should go to help keep our taxes down. We're all paying for that. And again, I've told you I'm not much interested in enterprise accounts. I realize each division has got to run and make its own money, but it's all the same pot of money. It's all from the same group of people. So I'm definitely not in favor of some of this trash talk we're talking about as far as bringing in trash, shipping trash in here to the gasification plant that we're still looking at, the streamline recycling. You know, these are things that when we make these decisions, it's affecting the whole next generation, not just our generation here. And a lot of problems that we have is they're brought to us at the last minute. We have a solar energy program brought to us 2 weeks ago, about 4 weeks ago, and then brought back 2 weeks later and wanted us to pass it. And I'm just, you know, these things need study. I see what Somerset County has taken 2 years to do studies on the windmill project. It looks good from the outside, but let's talk to other communities that have these things and see if that is a good thing. We're talking about saving $111,000 a year in our electric bill. While that's good on the up front, what are going to be our costs down the road? What's 20 years? 20 years from now is a long time, and then it's not a long time. So it'll come up fast on us, but we need to do more. We need to do more to help the businesses here, to help them expand, to help them grow and show them.
Let me ask you this, Bob. What would you do if you were county executive and you had the ability to influence the council to encourage businesses to come here? I mean, tax breaks, what? What would you do?
Okay, first of all, I mean, we're still losing jobs in this county. You can look at the statistics. We're still losing jobs in the county. Over the last year, I'm going to try to recall off the top of my head, $700, $900 jobs less than what we had last year this time. So those companies are leaving either because of economic times for them or the or there's just the unemployment rate so high in some places. But first of all, we have got to get out and get more businesses here. As I've said before, I don't see us getting the Crown Cork and Seals, the Campbell Soups, the Dresser Wayne companies back here at this time. This economy is just not that way. Maryland is ranked the 49th worst state in the Union Nation to do business with. Wicomico County, through some of the initiatives that we have started and the council has passed, we are starting to get better. We're the last county to get rid of the inventory tax in the state of Maryland. So why did it take so long? And yet we're on a phase out over 7 years. One thing to do is just bring that on up and let's go ahead and cancel that now. We're at our third year now. Correct on that, Rick?
It's not 7 years, it's five years.
5 years, but it's 7% a year. I'm sorry, 7% a year. It's 35%, so it's 7% a year. So we're on a third year of that. So we need to go ahead and move that forward a little bit faster. Our companies need help, and if they're going to be able to keep the employees here, they've got to be able to pay the employees. Actually, talking to Warwick, one of the top jobs that they produced out of Warwick was an engineering manufacturing engineer. And those graduates left Warwick making $50,000 to $70,000 a year, depending on their expertise. You know, we've got a great school. We've got three great schools in this area. I mean, all within a 15-minute drive. And we need to. Our education is a big thing. We've got to be able to keep businesses here, and we've got to recruit businesses to come here. But we're not going to be able to recruit businesses from Delaware, North Carolina, Virginia. We've got to send people out from Wicomico County to bring other businesses that are in Maryland now, possibly somebody in Anne Arundel, Montgomery County, that has that rain tax that they're suffering from. We don't have the rain tax now. So we need to go out to those companies and see what we can do to bring them here.
Just real quickly, too little too late in terms of your initiatives, not enough study, things coming back too quickly? What do you say?
No, not at all. In fact, that you have to be deliberate in your planning. You have to do your due diligence to look at the impacts. Now, Bob was talking about completely eliminating the inventory tax immediately. Well, that's a multi-million dollar hit to the county budget. Now, how are you going to tell the schools we're going to fund them what they need? How are you going to tell the people who rely on our sheriff's deputies to keep them safe at night or during the day when we don't have the revenue to pay for those? We are actually creating jobs now. One of the things that is going to be the mark of our administration is the new Vision Action Committee that I put together with major decision makers from all around the community, from education, from farming, from the hospital, so forth. At one of our meetings, we had a local business person, Sandy Fitzgerald Angela from Pohanka, tell us that she could hire people to come to work for her, but they can't get to her because they can't afford to get driver's licenses. Ray Hoy, the president of Warwick Community College, is a member of that action committee. The two of them started talking about maybe Warwick can provide a driver's education class. Sandy said, I'll donate the vehicles. Ray Hoy says, we'll do the program. And right now, there are 30 people enrolled in driver's education at Warwick who will be eligible to get work after they finish that, that would not have been there otherwise. And so this is how we are making things happen. But it takes collaboration. It needs getting the right people around the table, and it means actually having a plan. I've heard a lot about we ought to do things different. We ought to go out and do this. There's very little in how. We're actually making the how work.
By the way, I want to turn to education. The education budget. What is $37.7 million? I guess is what I figure I saw for the education. How satisfied are you with in terms of this contribution to the education system? I know that I think it was John Friedrichsen, the superintendent, wanted more. Are we sustaining the education system the way it should be? Because he says, gee, if I don't get X, then I'm going to have to, you know, not have investments for computers and so on. Yeah. What do you say to that?
I'm not convinced that there's a direct correlation between amounts of money poured into education and the quality of the product that comes back. I think it depends on how that money is allocated through the resources. We've always tried to make a priority of what money that we do provide goes into classroom instruction. We need to first attract and keep the best teachers so that they've got the strong morale. It doesn't help when you're one of the poorest counties in the state right next door to the richest. And then we have Sussex County and Delaware. Both of these areas are real competitors when it comes to attracting talent to Wicomico County, and so we are challenged to give them the resources they need to teach well. When we've had the opportunity to apply additional resources to the school system, again, trying to keep matching or recurring revenues to recurring expenses. When we've had extra money available, we've put it back into schools for safety, to let them upgrade their safety mechanisms there, to advance their technology equipment that they have available for all the kids, so that our kids are competitive and come out of school with the same basic feel for what's out in the world as people from other areas. But I think you'll hear most people say we never have enough. But again, I think our challenge is to make sure that what we do have is invested wisely and spent wisely and has an impact on the quality of the product at the end.
Bob, are we spending too much on education here? I think you voted against. I think it was the construction initially of the new Bennett Middle School. What do you think? It's too much?
That's a tough question, in a sense. Whether or not it's too much, I don't know if that's a fair question. Yeah, let's start off with the Bennett Middle. I did vote against Bennett Middle School, but I didn't vote against it because of the school or what it was actually costing. What I voted against was the location. Having grown up on a farm, you learn soil types. You learn what it is. That soil was designated as hydric soil. There was actually two studies done on whether or not it would hold the school. Hydric soil means that the water table stays between 0 and 10 inches year-round. I'm not arguing the fact that Bennett Middle did not need some work done to it, whether it needed to be remodeled. We never really did a complete study on whether or not it needed to be remodeled or whether it needed to be rebuilt. That was a good question. Too much money. We're never spending enough money on our children as far as being able to educate them and bring them forward. Do I think a school like a New Bennett Middle or New Bennett Senior is going to increase the education? No. By the test scores, you can tell already the school is not what does it. I think you look at Warwick Community College, that's a well-built school, good classrooms, everything else about it is top-notch, and yet it comes in cheaper than what we're paying for Bennett Senior High. So I think we could have had a better value for our dollar, no doubt about that. But I want to increase the laptops. I want these students to be much further than when Rick and I went through school in the seventh grade at Y Junior. There was problems then. So yes, I want to spend more money as far as being able to make it, but I want them to be good stewards of the money. We've all heard about the spending going on over there now that we're not really happy with, as far as some of the money being spent for lunches and meals. But, you know, Rick, in his earlier part of his administration, gave the County Board of Education much more money than what was due to them as far as maintenance of effort. And that has got us into the point now where every year, I don't know if everybody understands what maintenance of effort is. It means if I give you $10 this week, I've got to give you 10 plus maintenance of effort next week. Okay, we'll go this on a yearly basis. But should you give them more money like Rick did in the earlier part of his administration, $4 and $5 million some years, then we've got to keep making that same payment. And then it's based on that payment on. So it's a fallacy program, I think. I just don't agree with the way it's done.
Let me give you, you got about 30 seconds or 46, okay. So do that.
Okay, thank you. First of all, we did not exceed maintenance of effort by that level. I wish we had had the ability to do that. My first budget was $1 million over maintenance of effort. The second budget was $750,000 over maintenance of effort. It's never been $4 or $5 million. The way Bob describes it, with all due respect, is not what maintenance of effort is. Maintenance of effort is the constant yield of education spending. It's based on enrollment. And so whatever you spend per student this year, the law requires you to meet that amount next year. And if you can't, you apply for a waiver. And so maintenance of effort fluctuates with the enrollment in the school system. And maintenance of effort is simply a minimum spending provided by law. It doesn't allow for improvements. It doesn't allow for increases in technology or upgrades in the teaching environment. And so, again, it's about constant yield, or it's about progressing and doing more.
We've been speaking with Wicomico County Executive Rick Pollitt, who is running for a third term. He's being challenged by Republican Bob Culver, and we appreciate that both of you stopping by and having a little chat with us.
Thanks very much, Don. Hope everybody comes out to vote.
Okay.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
It's called the Fiddlers Convention, and it will be bringing in fiddlers from around the country to participate in a bluegrass extravaganza. The event will be returning for the 22nd year to the coolest small town in America, that is Berlin, from September 19th through the 21st. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Bluegrass and the fiddle are fused together in American history, with the instrument reaching the shores of the New World and finding a home in the Appalachia country. We thought we would take a look at that enduring question. What makes a fiddle as opposed to a violin? Well, of course, they are one and the same, but their styles are clearly different. One finds fiddlers improvising throughout a song, sometimes much to the irritation of the other instruments, and they stand in stark contrast to the heaviness of the guitar or the banjo. So we thought we'd turn to Lucy Cochran, who has been playing since she was very young and who will be participating in this year's event. First of all, how did you get into playing the fiddle?
It was kind of funny. I didn't want to do it at all at first. There was a violin program starting at my elementary school, and my parents signed me up, and I begrudgingly went to group lessons. And after a little while of doing the classical thing, it sort of made sense for me to fall into bluegrass because I grew up listening to that and country music. My parents were big country and bluegrass fans. My dad really loved Jimmy Martin and those kinds of folks, but he was also a big fan of Alison Krauss. Alison Krauss is a really awesome fiddle player, first of all. She got her start doing fiddle contests, and I guess she started touring with her band Union Station sometime in the 80s, and they've kind of progressed from a straight-ahead bluegrass band to more of a mainstream act, and like I think she's been on the radio. I know she's had music videos. I would classify her nowadays as more of a rootsy country thing than a bluegrass thing, but there's definitely bluegrass undertones in their music.
Give me a sense of history when it comes to bluegrass.
Well, bluegrass, I kind of like to tell people that it's like the younger, hipper cousin of old-time mountain music. It's like, well, Bill Monroe is credited with inventing, quote-unquote, the style. And it's kind of like he took old-time mountain music and gave it a rock and roll makeover. And which is kind of funny to think of now, but back in the day, he really was a rock star, and people went crazy over the music. It was this new wild thing on the scene. And basically, old-time mountain music was sort of a functional style of music. It was there for dancing and for functions, for parties, and bluegrass music. It wasn't the first time, but it was an early example of country music intended for listening. It was more of a performance art than a background thing.
And what's the difference between a fiddle and a violin?
Well, first of all, I get asked that question all the time, what's the difference between a fiddle and a violin? And it's really stylistic. I've always played bluegrass and country music, and I would never call it a violin. Just as a violin, a classical violinist would never call it a fiddle. It would just be kind of silly. I don't really know why or how that came about. But yeah, country styles are fiddle, and jazz, classical, rock is violin. And I guess the fiddle started in at least old-time music, which comes from the Celtic tradition, as the driving force in dance bands. And in the old days, there were even times when there wasn't a band, and it was just a fiddle leading a dance. It's really, like I said, the driving force behind that kind of music, and it is easily the loudest instrument in bluegrass music, so it sort of serves the same purpose.
Is it sort of lead, or does it harmonize with it, but also just simply taking off on its own? Is it reflecting the melody necessarily, or is it when you're playing there on the stage, how does that work?
Well, all of the above. Bluegrass music is nowadays more improvisation oriented. Any instrument in a bluegrass band that takes a solo is pretty much going to be improvising, usually based off the melody, but branching off to complement it in different ways. And that differs from the old-time predecessor in that in an old-time string band, everyone will play the same melody over and over and over. So that's really what sets bluegrass music apart and makes it more exciting in a way, because the fiddle isn't unique in the band. You know, the fiddle, the mandolin, the banjo, they're all doing things to complement the melody at times, but when they get their chance to shine or chance to solo, they're going to usually play something different and more unique.
As I was reading about this, they were talking about how the fiddle will often come in between phrases.
You're talking about fills. It's kind of a funny dance because, like I said, the fiddle's not the only lead instrument, so you kind of have to figure out when you're in a band setting who's going to fill the gaps between the vocal phrases. So you can pretty much improvise through the whole song as a fiddle player. And, you know, banjo players and guitar players get a little annoyed at fiddle players sometimes because they never stop. They just play through the whole thing, which is kind of a bluegrass thing. But there are definitely spots when the singer is singing and takes a breath when the fiddle can chime in. And then, you know, between verses, they'll leave a whole solo for each instrument.
How much improvising are you doing on stage?
Pretty much the whole time. Yeah. There are standard bluegrass songs and a repertoire of fiddle tunes that you're sort of expected to know if you're going to be on stage with a bluegrass band. But unless you're playing an instrumental tune where basically like in jazz, you'll play the head and then improvise off of that. If you're just playing back up to a singer, you're pretty much just going to be playing what you feel like playing the whole time.
By the way, I have to ask you, because you mentioned that you played some classical music and then you began to play the fiddle.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see as obviously the difference between the two, but what do you think you learned or understood from classical music that then translates in some fashion to what you're doing now?
Well, I should back up. My first year probably of playing the fiddle, or violin, if you will, would maybe technically be considered classical, but there's that whole initial learning of an instrument period. You know, I don't think I'd been playing long enough in a classical style to really have any firm grasp on it before I, you know, branched out to what I was more interested in. I did take some classical lessons later on in college, and that was really beneficial to my playing all around. I had a lot of bad habits that I'd picked up, you know, when I was younger and never been corrected. You know, if anyone out there is a fiddle player, they'll know that the left hand collapsed wrist is really horrible technique. And it wasn't until college that it was corrected that I should have my wrist out, and things like that, that just make it much easier to navigate the instrument. I did a lot of work through classical technique on my intonation and stuff like that. I can't really say for sure if there's a specific bluegrass technique as much as just a technique for the overall instrument.
So when you get up there, what does it feel like to play? Why are you drawn to playing this?
It's sort of indescribable beyond that. I can't tell you why I have this drive in me to play music and why I want to play music for other people and with other people, but my life, it's one of the best things that I've got going on, and I just love it.
So do you play with a lot of different bands, or do you play with a particular band? I mean, how does that work for you?
Over the years, I've played regularly with certain groups. I've had a couple of my own bands. But the great thing about bluegrass music is, you know, with a standard repertoire, you can kind of pick up with anybody. And, you know, I can't even tell you how many bluegrass bands I've played shows with and traveled with. But aside from that, I'm currently working on my own sort of bluegrass country crossover project. And that's still in its infantile stages.
What is it that you're working on?
I'm really excited about it. I've had this vision for a long time that I wanted to have an all-female bluegrass band because there are so few of them. And back in, I guess it was February, I started racking my brains, you know, who are these girls going to be? Because I really want to put it together. And I was able to come up with a really awesome group of lady musicians that I knew from college and different walks. And they all play bluegrass to a certain extent, but, you know, there's rock and roll influence, there's country influence, there's some R&B, and we got together in March and made an EP, and it's not out yet, but it will be soon, and we're very excited about it.
So is fiddle playing predominantly men? Is that a male's game, or is there more women coming into it? What are you seeing?
You know, I think the music industry in general is a man's game. And a lot of men say, oh, it's so much easier for women. I kind of beg to differ. It's easier to a certain extent to get started if you're a very attractive woman in the entertainment industry. But there are not as many female instrumentalists as singers, as, you know, front women. But that being said, I do happen to know quite a few female fiddle players. But usually when I get picked up to play in a band, I'm the only girl. I'm really used to playing in groups with all men, and in bluegrass music especially, it's usually older men. You know, it's old people's music.
Now, do you think that your approach, because you're a woman, is going to be different?
I've been told that the fiddle is sort of an effeminate instrument, and in a bluegrass band especially, where all the other instruments have sort of a heavy picking, clucky sound, to have like that really flowy, smooth sound over it just kind of adds some contrast. And I've been told that my playing is feminine. I don't really know what people mean by that.
Wait, I was going to say, what does that mean?
I'm not really sure. I think that as a fiddle player, I tend toward the aggressive side. I have a really heavy right hand, my bow hand. There are a lot of fiddle players that have a very light touch. I don't think that I'm one of them. But I do look for opportunities to play what I would call pretty lines.
What are pretty lines?
just something to soften up the sound every now and then, round out the edges. And there's the best way I could put that into words.
So why don't we have you get your fiddle out here and go ahead and show us a few of the techniques.
Sure. Well, first of all, something that sets country fiddling apart from any other violin styles would be double stops. You know, those are common in classical music too, but in sort of a different way. It's common to hear a bluegrass fiddle player play double stops throughout an entire tune. And what that is hitting two notes at once. So instead of just hitting on one string, you get the two together. So here's just a little phrase without double stops first. So that's pretty basic single note melody. So I'll do the same thing again, or rough with the same thing, with double stops. Oftentimes an open string will be used as a drone, which is something that comes out of older styles. So yeah, that's double stops for you.
And now I understand that you do a lot of like short, little short notes. Can you give a little demonstration about that? And it almost as if seems as if the bow kind of almost bounces off the strings.
There's little embellishments like that come out of like the Celtic styles trills. So that's just a quick turn to either a note above or a note below the melody note that you are landing on. Some folks get a little more crazy with that, but I don't know. I just stick to simple trills in within a melody line.
Earlier we were talking about old-time music as opposed to what's current. Describe for me what the difference is in terms of the music that you're playing there.
Well, like I said before, bluegrass is really heavy on improvisation, and there's some of that in old-time music, but most old-time fiddle tunes tend to be a little bit more rhythmically oriented, groove-oriented than improvised styles. Old time is also really heavy in double stops, and there's actually, I'll show you an old time bow pulse that you won't hear in bluegrass, which is basically if you're pulling the bow down in one direction or up in one direction, you're kind of going to slow down when you get to the middle of it and then speed up again and give it a push, and it sounds like... I don't know that there's not room for it, but I've just not heard a bluegrass fiddle player do that. Sometimes I get mixed up and we'll put that in with the bluegrass stuff, but it's pretty classically old time. Oh, another technique would be the shuffle.
So what's the shuffle?
So there's a couple different kinds of shuffles. There's a tune that is every fiddle player's first tune, Boil the Cabbage Down, and... basically, it's just the bow strokes go long, short, short, and it sounds like this. And sort of a variation on that would be what some people refer to as the trick shuffle. It's banned in contests. They don't let you do it because it's... the main characteristic of a little bit overplayed tune called the Orange Blossom Special, but I think it's really fun and it's got a lot of different applications, but this basically, it skips and it goes across a three strings instead of just two, so I'll show you that.
So let's have you play a little, and Nathan Glendinnen, who's organizing the music part of the convention, he can go ahead and join you on guitar. So what would you like to play?
This is an old fiddle tune by the name of Bill Cheatham.
Thank you. go, right nice. There. That's nice. Why don't you go do ahead one more? Anything? What is your favorite song to play?
Gosh, these days I really like playing Big Mon, and that's an original tune by Bill Monroe.
Okay. So why don't you play a little of that?
Yeah.
Let me ask you one final question. What advice would you give to somebody who wants to take up the fiddle, who wants to pursue it? Because it seems, you know, as you listen to what you're playing, it seems very complicated. What advice would you give?
I think that the single most valuable thing to me throughout my playing career is playing with other people. And when I was young, and just beginning to play, it was really kind of intimidating to me when I was going around to bluegrass festivals and saw all these musicians that were really awesome, just not really being sure how I was going to get from where I was to where I wanted to be. And the best thing that you could possibly do is play music with people that are better than you, and that will elevate your playing beyond what you thought possible.
Well, we appreciate you stopping by the studio and talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Lucy Cochran, who will be participating in the Berlin Fiddlers Convention, and she was joined by Nathan Glendinnen, who is organizing the event. It runs from September 19th through the 21st. The headlining act on Friday will be Frank Sullivan and Dirty Kitchen. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.